I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, when you are looking for selections for your child's library or for gifts for the other little people in your life, you may have looked for books with that gold or silver sticker from the American Library Association. It's their seal of excellence, if you will. Well, their picks for best kids books came out yesterday, and we will speak with one of the winners a bit later in the program. And if you're looking to fill the toy box, we will be talking about why toys are so often marketed to either boys or girls. And we'll talk about whether it has to be that way. That's our parenting conversation. But first, grab your popcorn. The Academy Award nominations were announced today. Joining us to talk about which movies and actors shined and who got left on the cutting room floor is Wesley Morris. He's a film critic with the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Wesley. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Hello. How are you?
Well, I'm better now that I'm talking to you about this.
Aww.
Even though it always makes me feel bad because I'm thinking about all the films that I missed because you still won't babysit like I keep asking you. Come over so I can catch
up. You keep bringing that up.
I know. Well, let's start big. The Martin Scorsese picture Hugo had the most nominations with 11, including, of course, for Best Picture. What's so special about this film?
You tell me, Michelle.
Oh, no.
I mean, that's not fair. Martin Scorsese's movie it's good. The people who love this movie, they really love it. My problem with it is basically that it's about film preservation, and it's one of Martin Scorsese's pet projects. He loves that, and I think it's a beautiful thing to want us to care about, and it's an interesting way, you know, using the story of a kid and his, you know, this mysterious man that he finds working in a train station is a great vehicle for that. It's just not a timeless movie to me. It feels very much, it's not political, but from a cinematic standpoint, it kind of is. It's sweet, but pointed in a way. And I think that people who love this movie kind of love its innocence.
All right.
You've seen better from our friend Martin Scorsese.
Well, we'll see. And another one of the big winners was The Artist with 10 nominations. Mm-hmm. And I would play a clip, but it was a silent film. And
We just won't say anything.
But it was reported that by the Telegraph in the UK that some people walked out of the theater and requested refunds because they didn't realize it was a silent film. So tell me what you thought.
What is wrong with people? I don't understand.
They don't read your reviews ahead of time.
That would break Harvey Weinstein's heart since he's pouring a lot of money into trying to get people to see it and understand why they're there. You know, this is a movie. You know, what's interesting about these nominations to me is that there is a kind of return to some distant era. You know, Scorsese's movie is set in a train station, you know, many, many, many decades ago. The Artist is set during the silent era and is itself a silent movie. And I think the resistance with The Artist, I think if people are resisting it, I think it's that they're being told it's something they should want to see without actually having had the opportunity to sort of decide whether they want to see it on their own. So it takes on this medicinal quality that I think kind of harms it in the public's eye, I think.
Well, that's interesting because there's one more film that we want to talk about where that criticism is being made. It's not nominated yet because it just came out. So let's hold that thought for a minute. We're talking about the Oscar nominations that were just announced today. My guest is Wesley Morris, film critic for the Boston Globe. All right, well, let's talk about the women who shined on the screen, The Help. Very controversial film. It's one of those polarizing films. You got to kind of tread lightly before you ask your friends about whether they liked it or not.
Did you notice that we took a deep breath before you said, yeah.
Four nominations. Here's a clip featuring Best Actress nominee Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer, who's a nominee for Best Supporting Actress. And worth mentioning that Octavia Spencer's already been honored by the Golden Globe. So here it is.
Hold on, those are Miss Hillis. She looked like the winning horse at the Kentucky Derby. All them flowers and bows.
Got that paprika on them.
Oh. Forgive me, Lord, but I'm going to have to kill that woman, Abilene. Now she going to put pencil marks on the toilet paper.
Did she?
Mm-hmm. But I carry paper in from my own damn house. That fool don't know.
Now, okay, deep breath. This is a film that was based on the best-selling novel, on the bestseller list for just weeks and weeks and weeks, if it isn't mm-hmm. still there, about mm-hmm. sort of telling the story of African-American maids in the kind of the civil rights era and kind of their story and how.
Yeah, I mean, look, you just played that clip and my eyes kind of welled up a little bit because what you... there's two ways to go about feeling about this movie. The one is the movie itself and like what those two women do to you. And the Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer are really good in this movie. I think they'll both win, by the way. But you know, then you have the sort of meta problem, which is what they're doing in this movie and what else you've seen Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer do this year. And this was it. These were the two biggest parts for any actress in any movie, for any black actress in any movie all last year. And you kind of have to ask yourself in 2010 or 2011, 2012, why that persists. That's always been my question with this movie.
Yes. And that's one of those deeper conversations that people either get it or they don't. You know what I mean? It's one of those conversations people either get it or they don't. Worth mentioning, Jessica Chastain was also nominated for Best Supporting Actress. And so, you know.
She's really good in that movie, too. And she, amazingly enough, she could have not made the cut because she had six movies that she was eligible for last year.
But that tells you something, doesn't it? Whereas Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer do not.
Michelle, it's a different show.
There it is. A long one. As for Best Actor, George Clooney, nominated for The Descendants, who, as expected, he also was just honored by the Golden Globes. This is a very beautiful, interesting movie out of Hawaii, but we only have a minute left, so I want to talk about Demian Bashir, who starred as an illegal immigrant in A Better Life. Yes. It was a bit of a surprise for some people.
It's been a building surprise, but when the Screen Actors Guild nominated him, a couple months ago, it began to make people open their eyes and say, whoa, what is going on there? What are people seeing in this movie that nobody saw?
Tell me, what is it that you think people saw? As we mentioned, it's about an illegal immigrant who's trying to figure out how to stay in this country so he can take care of his son.
Well, it's not just any. He's a gardener in Los Angeles. And this is no pun intended, it's in people's backyards. And this guy is telling a story that a lot of the people who are in the academy have deal with in some way because they hire guys like this to work for them. And he's trying to live the American dream, so to speak, and it takes a horrible turn. It's a very quiet, dignified performance. He's really good. I'm shocked they noticed it.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Wesley Morris, film critic for the Boston Globe. He joined us from Boston. Wesley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This Sunday, HBO unveils its newest TV series. It's called Luck. It's set in and around the world of horse racing, and it's loaded with thoroughbred talent. David Milch created it. Michael Mann is the executive producer and directed the pilot. And the stars include Dustin Hoffman and Nick Nolte. Our TV critic David Biancooley has this review.
It isn't a long shot that David Milch's newest series for HBO, called Luck, will be on a par with his HBO series Deadwood. It's a sure thing. That's because HBO sent out all 9 episodes of the show's first season for preview, so there's no guesswork here. The racetrack is at the center of Luck, with every character and plotline orbiting around it. But you don't have to like horse racing or even understand it to get pulled in and swept along. It examines the track and its various intrigues from every possible perspective, from the owners and trainers of the horses to the jockeys riding them and the gamblers betting on them. We go from the executive suites to the stables, spending time getting to know the people and problems of each. It's like Downton Abbey with thoroughbreds. And speaking of thoroughbreds, that description extends to just about everyone working on Luck. What a collection of collaborators. David Milch hit it big before Deadwood with NYPD Blue in the 90s. Movie director Michael Mann produced 2 visually stunning TV series, Miami Vice and Crime Story, in the 80s. One of the biggest TV stars of Luck, Nick Nolte, became a star thanks to Rich Man, Poor Man in the 70s. And the other biggest star of Luck, Dustin Hoffman, is new to series television, but his stardom stretches all the way back to The Graduate in the 60s. And now, here they all are doing great work at the same time. Milch throws us into the world of this California racetrack just as forcefully and as assuredly as he did when introducing us to the mining town of Deadwood. Mann directs the pilot with one eye as a documentarian and the other as an artist. Scenes and images look real, but often are beautiful, especially the racing scenes. The pictures, as well as the scripts, capture the raw power of the racehorses, who in the opening episodes often are reined in, waiting patiently for the proper time to break free and show their stuff. The actors are exactly the same way. Dustin Hoffman plays Ace Bernstein, a powerful player who's just been released after 3 years in prison. Nick Nolte plays Walter Smith, a former trainer who now owns a horse for which he has secret high hopes. And while the other actors and actresses in Luck spend the opening episodes establishing their talents as well as their characters, Hoffman and Nolte play it cool, biding their time in the rear of the pack. Until, almost effortlessly, they stretch their muscles and show what they're made of. This is a sample from Episode 3. Not a pivotal scene, just a nice one. Hoffman's ace is considering a young financial whiz in his business firm for a more lucrative job and summons the kid to his luxurious office for a private meeting. Patrick J. Adams plays the young man. Hoffman, as ace, shows his hand right away.
Do you make $1 million? Simple question.
No, sir.
Go home. Come back tomorrow. Tell me every thing you did between now and then. If I like what I hear, I'll give you $1 million for the next 12 months that you work for me.
Doing what?
That's the first thing you write down. Before I left here, I asked him a stupid question.
Hoffman plays Ace like a coiled snake, while Nolte plays his character like a battered veteran boxer. And there's so much other talent on screen, singling out some would almost be unfair to the others. But if you're a Deadwood fan, you'll see some familiar faces. You'll see them from other superb TV shows as well. Eventually, you'll even see Michael Gambon, star of my favorite TV miniseries of all time, The Singing Detective. Finally, there are the horses, these majestic creatures who are called upon at times to share scenes and interact with various human cast members. How the horses react to each person, that feels primal, honest, real. And so does Luck. The way this HBO series jumps out of the gate this first season, it'll be back for another lap around the track. Bet on it.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. When Keith Sutherland ended his very long, very intense days as Jack Bauer on the Fox series 24, few people, including Sutherland himself, expected him to be starring in another TV series right away. But tonight, in a special sneak preview of a new Fox series that will begin March 19th, Sutherland returns to television. The series is called Touch, and Sutherland plays the father of an 11-year-old son who has some significant disabilities and some very significant abilities as well. Our TV critic David Biancooley has this review.
The new Fox series Touch doesn't begin with Kiefer Sutherland, who plays a father, a widower, raising a withdrawn preteen son with behavioral problems. It begins instead with the son, Jake, played by David Mazouz, providing the narration that opens the series. By the time the opening narration is over, you already know you're watching something a little different.
The ratio is always the same, 1 to 1.618 over and over and over again. The patterns, mathematical in design, are hidden in plain sight. Just have to know where to look. Things most people see as chaos actually follow subtle laws of behavior. Galaxies, plants, seashells, these patterns never lie. But only some of us can see how the pieces fit together. 6,919,377,000 of us live on this tiny planet. This is the story of some of those people. There's an ancient Chinese myth about the red thread of fate. It says that the gods have tied a red thread around every one of our ankles and attached it to all the people whose lives we're destined to touch. It's all been predetermined by mathematical probability, and it's my job to keep track of those numbers. transmit the connections for those who need to find each other. The ones whose lives need to touch. I was born 3,786 days ago on October 26, 2000. I've been alive for 10 years, 5 months, 17 days, and 14 hours. And in all that time, I've never said a single word.
Jake has characteristics of being both mute and autistic, but apparently he's something else entirely. He spends his time drawing tiny patterns of numbers, collecting cell phones, and other things that his dad has come to accept but not yet to understand. But in the opening episode of Touch, the explanations come quickly. They may not make too much sense, at least at first, but they're intriguing. Touch is created by Tim Kring, whose last TV series was NBC's Heroes. That program also focused on seemingly ordinary people who turned out to possess extraordinary gifts, and whose gifts, in turn, tied them to some sort of important destiny. Heroes went downhill after its first two seasons, but was fun to watch for a while, and had an enjoyable, anything-can-happen comic book feel. Touch, though, is less like the story of Peter Parker turning into Spider-Man than Helen Keller finding a way to communicate. And the center of the story, at least at first, isn't young Jake, though with the opening narration, he gets the first word. It's his father, Martin, played by Kiefer Sutherland, with all the angst and empathy that propelled him through all those adventures on 24. Martin lost his wife to 9/11, which means he's raised his challenged and challenging son as a single parent for almost the boy's entire life. His son won't speak, doesn't like to be touched, and is obsessed with numbers to the exclusion of almost everything else. But finally, Martin finds a website for something called the Teller Institute, suggesting that youngsters like his son may be special in quite a different way. Martin visits the Institute, which turns out to be a one-man operation. The man is Arthur DeWitt. He has an explanation for Jake's numerical obsession, and he's played by Danny Glover.
Mr. Baum, your son is one of those kids. He discovered the Fibonacci sequence on his own.
The what?
Yeah. A mathematical sequence discovered by a 12th century mathematician named Fibonacci. The patterns found in nature over and over again. The curve of a wave, the spiral of a shell, the segments of a pineapple. The universe is made up of precise ratios and patterns all around us. You and I, we don't see them. But if we could, life would be magical beyond our wildest dreams. A quantum entanglement of cause and effect, where everything and everyone reflects on each other. Every action, every breath, every conscious thought connected. Imagine the unspeakable beauty of the universe he sees. No wonder he doesn't talk.
My son sees all that.
Mr. Baum, your son sees everything. The past, the present, the future. He sees how it's all connected.
You're telling me my son can predict the future?
No, I'm telling you, it's a roadmap. And your job now, your purpose, is to follow it for him. It's your faith, Mr. Baum. It's your destiny.
Don't worry, I haven't given too much away. All this just sets up the premise of Touch, which will have the father running around trying to find and help selected strangers or stop certain accidents thanks to this mystical numerical roadmap. Basically, it's a variation on the new CBS series Person of Interest, except that the stories are propelled by a human computer, not an actual one. And in the pilot, several characters are indeed changed thanks to their interaction with Martin, suggesting how this series is likely to play itself out in the future. What remains to be seen, though, is whether future installments of Touch will play out as an interesting, interwoven narrative that's as satisfying as it is unusual, or, on the other hand, whether they'll just turn into some sort of metaphysical Mission Impossible, with new cases to solve each week, as in dozens of other adventure series. I don't know which way Touch is going to go, but I'm willing to stay with it to find out. Young Jake, with his gift of seeing into the future, he may know, but he's not talking. At least not yet.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey.
Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele are a team, a comedy team. Both are biracial, half black, half white.
And so we actually think that we're particularly adept at lying because on a daily basis, we constantly have to adjust our blackness.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Like, I mean, to terrify white people.
Yep, to terrify white people. That's one of the main reasons. And then
because, I mean, with our voices now, we sound very white. We are not intimidating anybody we talk.
Yeah, we sound whiter than the black dude in the college a cappella group. That's how white we sound.
NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports on their new sketch comedy series, which premieres on Comedy Central next week.
You can learn a lot about Key and Peele in a sketch they do in which Jordan Peele impersonates President Obama.
I just want to say that I know a lot of people out there seem to think that I don't get angry. That's just not true.
And Keegan-Michael Key plays Luther, Mr. Obama's anger translator.
Luther, first off, concerning the recent developments in the Middle Eastern region, I just want to reiterate our unflinching support for all people and their right to a democratic process.
Hey, all y'all dictators out there, keep messing around and see what happens. Just see what happens. Watch.
Keegan-Michael Key paces back and forth, flails his arms. Sometimes he puts his face right into the camera like he's about to punch it. As President Obama, Jordan Peele is unflappable.
I just want to say to my critics, I hear your voices, and I'm aware of your concerns.
So maybe if you can chill the out for like a second, then maybe I can focus on some you know?
Key and Peele say the idea came from a few different sources. First, they're fans of early Saturday Night Live, and one of their favorite sketches was the fake TV news.
If you remember Garrett Morris, and they say, and now for the Association of the Deaf, Garrett Morris will be doing the announcement. And then Garrett Morris would scream at the top of his lungs.
Our top story tonight.
Our top story tonight.
And so that was something we had talked about that we thought, wouldn't it be nice, you know, if we could find a way to finagle Obama's nature and use that as a nugget? You know what I mean? How would we get someone to interpret what we know he really wants to say?
They were even more inspired to write the sketch when a congressman shouted, "You lie," during one of President Obama's speeches.
The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegal.
Key and Peele say it bothered them that Mr. Obama barely reacted.
For him to have that much composure, it's
right.
Like, you don't have, no, not after that. It was really a burr. Jordan Saddle, he's like, come on, brother, if there's ever a time to get down to business, do it. How are you just going to put a finger up and keep talking regular?
Right.
Come on, man.
But, you know, that's kind of course, what we love about him, too, is mm-hmm. that he's so, you know, he's so even measured. He's so together. He's almost Spock-like
yeah.
in his logic and wisdom. You know?
And that Spock-like nature is something else about the president Key and Peele admire. Peele thinks Mr. Obama was the best thing to happen to black nerds everywhere.
Up until Obama, it was basically Urkel and the black guy from Revenge of the Nerds, Lamar. We had no role models. So he made us cool.
And they say he made it easier to be biracial. Jordan Peele grew up in New York. He was raised by a single white mother. Keegan-Michael Key was raised in Detroit. His mom is also white.
You go to school as a kid, and when your mom comes and the kids go, "That's not your mom.
That ain't your mama. Why are you lying?"
Which, as a kid, is like, that is a deep insult.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
that's our lifeline is our mom when we're little. So somehow I think that's that expectation at a very young age that we were supposed to live up to something because of what we looked like. I mean, I think that probably invaded our souls and gave us the need to do this comedy on some level.
Yeah. Yeah. I think,
did anyone ever make fun of you growing up because you didn't talk black enough?
Every single day of grade school.
I still make fun of them.
In one of their sketches, Key and Peele change the way they speak, depending on who's listening. It begins with Key by himself on a city sidewalk, talking on his cell phone.
Because you're my wife, and you love the theater, and it's your birthday.
A stranger walks up, played by Jordan Peele, who can hear what he's saying. So Key changes his voice to sound more black.
But they do have seats that are still left in the dress circle. So if you want to me to get them theater tickets right now, I'm going to do it right
now. What's up, dog? I'm about 5 minutes away.
Yeah.
As they part, you realize that the second guy had been changing his voice, too.
So he got that
oh, my God, Christian, I almost totally just got mugged right now.
I
love the posturing of it. I love that it taps into like stuff that no one's talking about.
Makisha Madden-Toby is a TV critic for the Detroit News.
How do people perceive you versus who you really are? How you let people perceive you? I mean, all of those things, I think they just brilliantly tap into those things.
Madden-Toby says Key and Peele will fill the void that was left on Comedy Central when comedian Dave Chappelle quit his show in 2005.
Comedy Central needed that voice again ever since losing Chappelle, and I think that they are pretty close to it.
Key and Peele are huge Chappelle fans, but for now, they're not sure their new show will reach as many African Americans as Chappelle's did. A tough crowd, they say.
It really concerns us.
To be terribly frank, yeah. That's just one of the things, I guess.
It concerns us that African Americans enjoy this show.
Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele. Their new show debuts next week on Comedy Central. Sketches include parodies of a reality cooking show, being related to Thomas Jefferson, and the little lies husbands tell each other about their wives. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is Morning Edition, edited by Renita Jablonski and Chuck Holmes. Our editorial staff includes Rena Advani, Shanita Anderson, Frederica Boswell, Jordana Hochman, Laura Krantz, Maeve McGoran, David McGuffin, and Jessica Smith with Nina Gregory at NPR West. Our senior supervising editors are Kitty Isley and Shannon Rhodes, and our executive producer is Madalika Kasika. The executive editor of news programming is Ellen McDonald. And our theme music was written by B.J. Lederman, arranged by Jim Pugh. You can follow us on Twitter, by the way. We are at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep. That's Inskeep. Renee's back with us on Monday. I'm Steve Inskeep.